in your world, what does the word intentional mean?
People get so much out of the stuff that I do, and it's really hard to define exactly what it is when you ask them, like, what is Rhodium or whatever, right? But the one through line, I've been trying to find what is the through line. And I think the through line might be around helping people achieve kind of their ideal life, whatever that is to them.
Welcome to Intentional Growth, a show that teaches you as a business owner and entrepreneur to view and run your company like a financial asset, which will allow you to enjoy work, create wealth, and make an impact. This mindset will help you focus on building a more valuable business and give you the choices to grow, acquire, reinvest, or exit and live the life you plan for, all with intention. And now here's your host, Ryan Tansom.
Welcome back, everybody. We are on the fourth and final episode of our mini series of demystifying business valuations. We have an owner success story today that is going to highlight all the concepts that we've covered in the last three episodes. And again, we've been talking about intrinsic financial value, based the value of a company based on its risk of its cash flow. And we are comparing that to the strategic transaction value, where there's a third party buyer that might give a premium or a discount to your business based on the purpose of the deal, because there's two people coming to the table and there's emotions or there's strategies that the buyer's bringing to the table, and they have intentions of or some idea of what they want to do with your company. And that's reflected in the value and the terms and conditions. And I have a dear friend that was willing to come back on the show. His name is Chris Yates. He's the CEO of Rhodium Weekend, as well as Centurica. I should say was the CEO of Centurica, which he's going to be sharing the story of how he sold that business. And a little bit of background on Chris is I met him 5-6 years ago. He was on the podcast. I've gotten to know his community of people and entrepreneurs. It's online entrepreneurs. Think about like content businesses, e-commerce businesses, SaaS products, and Chris brings together these people, and it's a lot of M&A, a lot of buying and selling of companies. So he's very familiar with this whole space, and he was willing to share in detail his exit of Centurica. They did due diligence for buyers of online businesses. So he would help a buyer assess the risk of the marketing and a lot of the analytics and a lot of the stuff that he was specialized in. Why this is relevant in this mini series is because Chris had two buyers that had completely different reasons that they wanted to buy his company. One of them was what we call an acqui-hire, and Chris will get into that. And what happened was there was a lot of deal fatigue and a lot of things that changed after there was an original conversation as he continued to learn what they were going to do with the company. And that all reflected in the valuation and the deal structure. And that compared to another offer where it was based on the valuation of an SBA loan, which essentially is the intrinsic value, because an SBA loan, a banker is going to underwrite the deal because they believe that the company is going to be viable to pay off that loan over the next 10 years. And so that's essentially the intrinsic financial value. So Chris had two offers and two buyers, and it's just amazing how in detail he was about giving what happened over the course of those two processes because of the purpose of the deal and how that impacted. And he was always able to fall back on the intrinsic financial value because he had built a good cash machine that had value based on the risk of the cash flow. So I just want to say thank you so much for Chris coming on the show and all the wonderful people he has around them. And I can't say enough about how much I respect Chris and everything he's doing and how well he was able to share his story and contribute to the Intentional Growth community again. Thanks everybody for tuning in. And I really hope you enjoy this interview with Chris Yates. You ever found yourself in your office after an executive meeting and you're sitting there going, I have huge decisions to make, whether it's hiring that next key employee, buying that next piece of machinery, buying a building, launching a location or product or whatever it might be. And you're sitting there going, is this the right decision? And then you think back about the original vision you had when you started the business or the vision you have right now that you know is possible in the marketplace. And you sit there and go, how do you know and how do I know that what I'm doing is the right thing? When realistically, you have the option to just take all the money home and solve for annual cash flow and essentially just have a job that's kicking out a lot of cash. The reason that you would do all those things is because you want to grow a company that's worth a bunch of money that gives you the freedom of choices to do what you want long term, whether that's take a back seat and be a passive investor, whether that's sell part of it or some of it, essentially just have as many choices as you want. But what we find is that most times entrepreneurs and business owners are solving for annual cash flow because they don't know how to measure and monitor the value of the business and where they are today and how what they're investing in doing is growing a more valuable business and how to measure that into the future. And I had experienced the exact same thing. I ran a family business that was doing 20 million in revenue, 100 and some employees. And my dad and I had this constant conversation back and forth about what we should be doing and where we should be going, but we never really knew whether what we were spending our time and money on was making us progress towards that eventual goal of having a valuation that we wanted that gave us the choices. So then you have to sit there and go, maybe I should just take the money home or I should just hope and pray. That is exactly why we created this financial assessment, because if you organize your financials in a certain way, and we have this financial foundation with four components, you take this assessment, it's 22 questions, you don't need your financials, and at the end result of it, there's a results page where Pat, my partner, and I walk through five videos to show you a case study of what good looks like and how to actually project out the future value of the company and how you can make the decision's clear today to say, if I do these things, what's the impact on cash flow today, my ability to fund my growth, take the distributions, pay for taxes, all while staying in line, progressing towards the valuation that I want. So go take the assessment below and I hope you enjoy. Mr. Chris Yates, we're back. How are you, man?
I'm doing well, Ryan. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, I'll tell you what, there's so much, so many emotions I was having. I was like, as I was thinking about having you back on the show, because I had a virtual assistant that reached out and actually got you on the podcast originally. And honestly, I was trying to think, was it 5 years ago or something along those lines?
Yeah, it had to have been. I believe you spoke at our 2018 event. So yeah, probably about 5 years.
I wonder if it was even 2018. Here's why it's so relevant, man. Because like I've met so many amazing people because of who you are, the connector, and you're just a giver, and just the whole Rhodium Weekend community. I just had to say that because that was one of those dominoes where, you know, like when you meet someone, a lot of other good things continue to happen in your life. And it proved true with you, man. And you have a wonderful story to share with us today. And I'm very excited. So why don't you just give for everybody just set a little bit of context of, you know, what you've got going on, who, you know, a little bit of your background, and we'll jump into your story.
Yeah, sounds good. So I'll do the brief version. So I started buying online businesses back early days. So sort of like 2009, 2010 was when I think we did our first deal with a business partner. Did that for several years, realized, man, this is super isolating. I want to find other people who I can talk about this stuff with. So I started an in-person event in 2012, which is now called Rhodium Weekend. So I've been doing that for a little bit more than 10 years now. And that's really just bringing together smart people who are in the kind of e-com, SaaS, content, some services, you know, sort of space that are digitally focused to share best practices and knowledge, and really rewarding for me. We've had, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in deals and stuff that have happened through that community. But one of the cool things it has also given me as a platform is some interesting deal opportunities. So one opportunity that came my way in 2015 was the original founder of a company called Centurica, was a member of the Rhodium community, had come out to events, and he approached me. He's like, Chris, there's like two people in the world I would sell my company to, and you're one of them. Why don't we do a deal? So we ended up, I ended up buying Centurica from him in 2015. And that is the company that I've focused my efforts over the last 7 years or so on growing. And we, you know, without giving away the punchline, we had an interesting outcome here recently, so which we're going to talk about today.
So, which I'm really excited because, you know, through the eyes of the buyer and understanding how different buyers, you know, view a company, what they're planning on doing with it, how that translates into a lot of the stuff, we've got some great highlights that you're going to be able to share us. But like, before we jump into that, Chris, like, why don't you give everybody like an overview of what Centurica was doing and what the skill sets were? Because you just had a very unique between the community and what that company did to place yourself in the middle of a lot of deal flow, a lot of chatter, a lot of things going on. So it's a pretty unique situation.
Yeah. So Centurica is a company which provides due diligence for companies that are acquiring online businesses specifically, you know, think e-commerce, that kind of thing. And what due diligence is in short is we look at the financials to make sure they actually match what the seller or sell side representative had claimed. And we also look at the sales and marketing channels to look for KPIs, trends, things like that to look for risk in those. And so that's what the company was doing. And what's happened in our industry, and we let's say sub 50 million or even, you know, sort of like sub $20 million value, enterprise value type companies that are in the digital space. I started in, as I mentioned, Wild West early days. And more recently, we've had lots of like billions of dollars flow in to fund companies who are kind of acquiring these businesses and rolling them up. And so Centurica for many, many years was I felt like I was trying to squeeze water out of a stone with that business. It was so niche. But over the last few years, that whole industry has grown. And Centurica, after, you know, putting a lot of hard work into building that brand and reputation over the years, was able to benefit from that wave. I like to say I got lucky, but you know, what is the saying? Luck meets something meets preparation.
Well, so hard work and opportunity, I think, is the Mark Cuban quote. Like yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. And so what happened was we got a little too lucky in that we started to get, because there was so much demand in the space for the services that we provide and we had this reputation, we were really a boutique shop. My business partner and I were really the key people. And then we had a team of contractors. So, you know, we had just tons of people asking for work, and the business totally kind of transformed as we started having more repeat clients that were these well-funded companies acquiring, you know, a business a month or a couple businesses a month needing our services. So quickly we found, man, we're getting stretched pretty thin because of this demand. And this is where we kind of, I guess I would just say we entered a crisis of what we want this business to become. We could have made the decision to really like, hey, let's make hay while the sun's shining and let's build out our team, let's build out our systems, or why don't we stay very profitable and very boutique? And actually, I remember a conversation you and I had when I was sort of in this crisis mode of like, you know, how do we, you know, what do we do here? Because we could take what we have now and just, you know, be really selective with clients, or we could, you know, kind of try to build out an infrastructure to really take advantage and grow much larger. But to get the business, the valuation of our business to a point where that investment would have made sense. We're talking a few years down the road, and who knows what can happen in a few years, as we've probably seen recently. So, so anyway, yeah, that was kind of where we're at when we started entertaining the idea of like, hey, you know, what do we do here? And maybe one of those options might be looking at a potential exit.
Chris, that was unbelievably helpful with the context too. And I'll just kind of drop a couple pieces of content that or concepts that we had pulled from a couple other episodes. We're like, you know, there's a gentleman going through our training, similar kind of pivotal point of like, hey, do I reinvest to create a long-term valuable asset? Or do I actually sell for annual cash flow and milk it for what it's worth while it is? But what you just addressed is that the industry or the, you know, different macro things could completely impact that decision based on like where you're going. And it's super fascinating because, you know, when we talk about the strategic transaction value of a deal, it's the purpose of the deal, right? And I've watched, like, you mentioned that, like, kind of the industry changing, man. Like, when I, like, was like 2016, 2017, when I was first started talking to you, I mean, you were buying like $50,000 to $100,000 websites or e-com sites. And then you get like multiple zeros now back behind these companies of how crazy the growth has had. So it's been really fascinating to watch where, like, all of a sudden, you know, PE firms are now like rolling around in the events and stuff like that, where before they weren't. So I personally watched it from the outside, some of the, you know, accelerated growth and the interest in your guys' space, which has been very interesting to watch. And so let's talk about, like, you know, maybe do you want to give an overview just of like kind of like what was going on when you mentioned a lot of money was coming in there. So maybe kind of set the landscape a little bit of like, what do you mean by a lot of money was coming in? How did that impact the industry and some of the things that who you were working with?
Yeah. So yeah, given that I was in the community or I was in kind of the community business with Rhodium, I had a pretty good exposure into a lot of like operating individual entrepreneurs. And historically that had been our core market. But we realized that there were opportunities with well-funded companies. We started having a few of them coming to us and asking about our services, and you know, I'd tell them, we charge, you know, whatever, X thousand dollars. And they're kind of like, oh man, you know, like I'm used to paying 25, 30, 150K for due diligence. And so we saw it as an opportunity, but that was like more traditional private equity. And we didn't really know how we were going to get into that. But around this time, there was a company by the name of Thrasio that became the fastest billion-dollar valuation in the US. And when you have, you know, somebody going out there leading the pack on a model, which for them was basically we would buy up a bunch of Amazon sellers, roll them up and raise money along the way, then a lot of other people saw that and they're like, hey, we could do this as well. And it launched this, you know, whole, and I should say, like, I don't have any interest in Thrasio or like, they were never a client of ours, but what we did benefit from as they went through that process was a lot of other people started doing the same thing and raising a lot of money. It was sort of like the new trend on like the block with
crazy,
yeah,
crazy
kind of
amount,
combining
wasn't it?
Venture capital with private equity in the digital space. It was like real new. And, you know, I think within a couple of years, a couple billion dollars had flowed in terms of like money that those aggregators had raised. And so many of them, and I obviously can't talk about specifics of who it was, but many of them were choosing us as their primary due diligence provider. And so when you go from working with a bunch of individual entrepreneurs who you might see once every few 3-5 years as clients to now we have clients who are coming to us and wanting our services, you know, multiple times a month and willing to pay, you know, a higher price for those services, the business dynamics really, really change as a result of that.
And the activity went off the charts. Cause I mean, I think about, I mean, Jimmy Fritz, he's probably listening. He sent me a picture at the last Roman weekend of like the amount of money that flew in and how many aggregators there were over the course of 12 months,
yes.
You know, put a lot of demand on your services. And so what I'm curious is, you know, you and I had that conversation about like what to do. Do we reinvest, build the infrastructure and how does that work? And then, you know, what happened after that, that led you to starting like, where was your mindset in, and then how did what was a trigger event that kind of set the events into order or events into motion?
Yeah, I think the internal reality of our business was that we were stretched really thin. My business partner was essentially the COO, you know, running the day-to-day of the reports and things like that. And he was working really, really hard. I was more in the business development, sales kind of focus for the company, marketing, stuff like that. I wasn't really able to add much value to the business because we kind of were turning people away, right? And so we were in this place where, you know, we had to do something. And around that time, one of the aggregators actually approached us to work with us as they wanted to be a client of ours. And in that process, I kind of had just on the side mentioned, because they were asking us, what's your capacity? We're looking to be real aggressive, you know, that kind of thing. I'm like, well, you know, if you sent us a deal a week, I think we could handle it okay. You know, he's like, well, you know, but I also said, yeah, we're looking at building out our infrastructure a little bit more to be able to handle more. If you let us know, we can kind of grow together. And he's like, well, yeah, we're kind of building out our internal due diligence process. Maybe would be interesting since we're both kind of doing the same thing to maybe there's some way to partner together. And that ultimately, you know, translated into them making an offer to acquire Centurica as kind of essentially what I would call an acquihire.
So what would you explain that for the listeners?
Yeah. So an acquihire, a typical Silicon Valley type acquihire might be a failed funded startup that has a lot of really talented people that they'd hired. And so somebody else comes along and basically buys that company for the talent. So they're acquiring them, but the reason they're acquiring them is for that talent. In the case of the aggregator, their goal was to aggressively pursue a $1 billion valuation. And they saw acquiring Centurica saving them about 6 months of that process because we already had all the SOPs, all the talent and the team to be able to handle, you know, the due diligence needs that they're going to have as a company. So that's really where their motivation was to rapidly supplement spin up their due diligence processes in-house.
So that is, so when we talk about the strategic transaction value, again, that's above and beyond the value of the company based on the risk of the cash flow, the intrinsic value, like you highlight it too. And we got done with the podcast a couple of weeks ago where we talked about the purpose of the deal when someone's selling to a third party and trying to figure that out. And because what you just highlighted it and if it's 6 months, I don't know what that opportunity cost was for them, Chris, because like, here's what I'm trying to get at is that there's the value of your company based on, you know, what you have for the cash flow, but then what that means to them, it might not be the same. And there might be way more value to them just spinning this up because of how long it would take. So like, I don't know how did you get into that mindset, like to truly understand what it meant to them?
So what I did was I kind of figured out what is the model of these aggregators. And at the end of the day, I'm totally butchering and simplifying it way more than need be, but their model was get an injection of equity, you know, come up with the idea. We're going to roll up a bunch of Amazon companies. Look, here's, you know, another company that's done it and they're now a $1 billion company. We're going to do the same thing. So they raise money, equity on that principle, and then they get big debt facilities and to go and acquire these companies, right? So, and then they get onto, in my mind, it's like sort of this track that they get on where now they're like, okay, we have the first deal, we have the second deal, we have the third deal. Okay, now we show revenue growth. Now we can go raise more either equity or debt at a higher valuation to go buy more. They go buy more. Then they do it again. So along the way, they're stepping up their valuation and it's all dependent on their ability to acquire. And the faster they acquire, the faster their valuation grows. So if you look at the valuation, if they're trying to get to $1 billion, 6 months could be, you know, opportunity cost on that. If they couldn't acquire, I mean, I don't know how you would put a number on that 6 months, but if it meant they could get to their valuation faster, and with more certainty and have their investors have more confidence they're able to do it, that's worth a lot of money to them, you know, potentially in the range of hundreds of millions, right?
I was going to say, man, if you actually would have gone into them and say, I know the IRR of you not hitting this in the next 6 months is X, who cares what my company's worth? Right. I would have loved to see that. Yeah, it's worth $100 million. Trust me, guys. But all joking aside, but like, I think that what you described right there, Chris, is you understood the buyer very well. And a lot of people, they don't really know what the purpose of the buyer's desire is. So they don't know how to tap into or understand what that future or what the value is going to mean besides just the risk of the cash flow. And when you were having these conversations, Chris, you know, you were a professional services firm, right? And there's a lot of assumptions around professional services firm that they're hard to sell, lots of earnouts, you know, you have to find someone to take over your job. But then this situation came across. We're in that spectrum of like not sellable professional services firm to I could sell this for a lot of money. Was there an evolution there, or was there a spectrum of where your head was at?
You know, I guess here's the tricky part with this aggregator. So from the buyer's lens, they saw the value as the systems we've created and the team we had in place. So they wanted, that was where their deal points really were focused on, right? Whereas any other buyer might be buying us for the cash flow. And when you think about it, so if they're trying to acquire a company that's already profitable, that has cash flow, now we have this tension between what's best for the business versus what's best for this buyer, right? And so this is where ultimately we ran into some issues, pretty substantial issues down the road, which we may talk about. But, you know, so I guess that was really, I don't know that I completely understood the magnitude of that and how critical and how hard it was to get this deal done because of that misalignment of those two things of what's best for the business versus what's best for, you know, this buyer. And I'm not sure if I touched on your exact question, but if you ask it again, I could try again.
No, that was absolutely a perfect point to jump into like this situation. Cause you said like, I mean, a lot of, I've never heard a word just like that about what's best for the business versus what's best for the buyer, however you worded that. I think that's that if you're not clear on what you want as the owner, then you're trying to figure it out in the moment, which is very difficult. So let's just jump right into it, Chris. Like what? So walk us through like how the conversations with the aggregator started and where did you start to notice this rub? And then we can kind of unpack kind of the situation as you see fit.
Yeah, we noticed the rub right away because their motivation was let's keep you know, my business partner and I around. That was their key thing. Me as the owner of the business, I can't be an employee again. So like it was a big leap for me to even think about this. But you know, so we're talking about the structure and the LOI and the conversations around the deal. We were pushing for, hey, our business is cash flow positive. This is a great business. We need cash up front to account for that. Whereas they're pushing hard for, You know, we want you to have equity in this company because this company is going to grow and it's going to become a $1 billion company. That's the value that we're offering you. So we had kind of dug our heels in. We want a certain amount of money up front. And they're like, hey, let's push as much of this onto, you know, hey, you get stock in our company as possible, right? So right early on, we started to notice that tension. And that ultimately, you know, we kind of went back and forth a lot. And thinking back on it, I should have walked away. My wife told me, this is way too complicated. Like this is, they're being, you know, sketchy, like just this, it's not worth it. But we continue pursuing it. And it's like, sometimes I feel like I'm a dog with a bone. Like when I see a problem, I want to figure out a solution that works for everybody. And so that's kind of what we did is we came up with a way where, you know, we would get like a certain dollar amount for this business, right? As kind of saying, hey, this is the cash that this business is valued at. You get 50% of that up front. And then we need this transition to happen. So knowledge transfer, we'll give you another 25% of the cash. That's about 3 months. And then train our team and hire a couple new people just to add some diversity to just you guys being the due diligence department. That's another, you know, 25% in 6 months when those milestones happen, right? So that's kind of like the cash upfront structure. And then they're pushing for an employment agreement as well with us. So myself, I'm like, look, I don't even spend 5 hours a week in this business and you're asking me to go full time. That's a huge leap, right? So I was pushing really hard to say, no, I don't, like minimum, and it's going to trail off over time. Like, you know, but whereas my business partner, he was okay. Like he was excited. This was be like a new career opportunity for him. He was okay with the full-time gig and things like that. And he was more essential to the business in terms of operations, which is what they really cared about anyway. So, you know, so basically we, you know, they structured employment agreements and those would kind of get to their full amounts after a period of time if we stuck around. And then the other thing is that they did want us to do equity in the business. And so from a seller's perspective, that can be really attractive, but you have to believe that that company is actually going to be successful and you never know what's going to happen, especially, you know, with these kind of more venture-y type businesses, like they may, like very real possibility they could have gone to zero within the period of time where our vesting would have happened, right? So mm-hmm. for us, there was a lot of uncertainty on that, but we also saw this as like, you know, this is great potential because we'd seen in the industry that these companies were growing, their valuations were growing, you know, a lot of opportunity there. So, but the big thing that, like, I think looking back on it should have been a red flag for me was the clawbacks. So this is a structure you don't typically see in a lot of deals unless it's kind of an acqui-hire situation. Yes, they were giving us cash up front, but if my business partner were to leave or I were to leave within a certain amount of time, they would have clawed the money, the cash back. So not only had the business would have been shut down, but we also would have lost the cash that we ultimately received for the business. So This early on, this was kind of the structure they were pushing for. The other thing I realized is that in this environment where, you know, you're not working with one person, you have your main point of contact in that company, but there's this whole shadow of board members and investors that are happening behind
voices.
And it was really hard to tell why we were getting like mixed messages throughout the deal as far like they were really asking, hey, do you guys have any other intellectual property? And we're like, well, yeah, we have spreadsheets. We're just really efficient with what we do. They almost didn't believe we were delivering the number of reports that we were. And so there was these things happening behind the scenes with investors and things like that. Their board members that, you know, were kind of clues to us that maybe not everybody was bought in. And that's a big lesson. Like if there is a decision maker that you have not talked to who can kill the deal, you have major issues. And so you need to get to that decision maker. And, you know, hindsight's 20/20. I wish I would have.
So, yeah, amen to that. There, Norm Brodsky, this guy that was on the show years ago, like that was one of his biggest things that he killed the deal over. There was some random person behind the scenes that was chirping in everybody's ear that he found out was the real problem. So absolutely great point. I want to go like, so there was a lot of different things you talk about, employment contracts, rolled equity, and some of those things were kind of earnouts based on metrics. So like, I want to go back to like even before when you started entertaining this offer and when you started seeing some red flags, and you're very an emotionally intelligent guy, Chris. So like I'm assuming you probably started seeing those fairly early. What was it what was the reason that you continued to pursue it? And here's the second part of that question is, was it, you know, the value so big compared to what you thought you could get? Or like, what was the reason behind going through some of those kind of painful dancing or the what you know the discussions with the people?
Yeah. So I have to be a little bit careful with how I share this, but let's just say that there were some internal dynamics where, you know, this would have been a good deal for some of the people involved because of what they wanted to do. And I was also pretty burned out on this business. And I didn't have the energy to, you know, let this deal fall apart and have to go, you know, okay, now we're going to rebuild. So it was a little bit of, I guess like a way out, but not really it wasn't a way out that really, it was something that fell into our lap way out instead of like a planned way out in terms of how you help people. Right.
And I think it's you just summarized, I think, Chris, so many people, like it's a way out that landed in my lap. And then you kind of go, huh? And I think what the story you just described, man, like I've been part of it with my own previous life. And a lot of people on the show were like, you start going down and then you go through all this misery and pain and time and conflict to get to the point where the way out is I now have to sign PTO requests. It's rolled equity. It's an employment contract. And I got a couple bucks up front with just as much stress. And now I have a boss.
Exactly.
I don't know if that summarizes it, but like it's a challenge. Because like when you started, did you know that the deal structure was going to kind of end up where it was, or did it slowly kind of retrade and change along the way?
Yeah, it retraded. And, you know, they ultimately backed out of the deal last minute. And it was sort of a situation where it's like, you know, they'd kind of chopped us down along the way. They started with this amazing spreadsheet that showed, look at all, you know, in 4 years, this is what your total value of your company will be worth and how much you'll get. And then the terms started getting in there and more, you know, chopping things down, and clawbacks started getting introduced. And ultimately, like, they came back to us in the end and said, hey, one of our investors, you know, had just been pushing the whole time, and they just didn't feel like the cash up front made sense. And rather than us trying to retrade this with you, like, we're basically backing out. And it was sort of like, hey, you could come back to the table if you're willing to take less cash up front, and, you know, that kind of thing. So it was like the frog in water. In order to cook it, you have to slowly turn the heat up. They started with this really nice thing, and then over time, it just sort of got chopped in all these crazy terms. It's not the price, it's the terms, right?
Mm-hmm. Was there any point, like, I don't know if you, did you know what the value of the company was prior to this discussion?
You know, not exactly, because given it's a professional services organization that's highly tied to one of the primary owners of the business, you know, it was difficult to know, you know, what is the replacement cost of that owner? How is that factored into the valuation? But, you know, we had like a number in mind, I guess, in terms of like if somebody were to pay us cash for the business now. But I wouldn't say that the thing is that what we knew is different buyers would probably value us differently, as we, you know, reality showed here. But what we thought was like, okay, let's look at the owner's benefit and let's talk about a multiple on that, you know? So it's more about what is the cash flow we're pulling from this business and what's a reasonable multiple on that. And that's the valuation we kind of had in our mind.
Well, which is super helpful, because just for the listeners, and I mean, you see deals, Chris. So there's a lot of people that have been on the show that have said that, and it's total bullshit because they've never actually been through evaluation, due diligence or anything. You're in the middle of the heart of all this stuff. So you have enough information to have a relatively decent judgment on that. I just want to put that out there, because it's not like you were just making something up that you pulled from some random place. So like, you having some parameters around knowing what that number is, I think is pretty solid. And then what was your discussions internally as this is going on? And then honestly, it had to have been emotionally draining. I mean, like, where was your mindset going when this finally, you kind of realized that you're grasping at straws?
So I guess in terms of internal conversations along the way, we're trying to figure them out. Like, what, you know, what are they doing? And you know, basically like, hey, here's where we need to hold fast in our terms. And, you know, so it was a lot about, you know, we were almost reacting, which is probably, it's really not a great place to be. Instead of kind of setting the terms, we're like trying to, you know, here, we need to really, they're asking for this. We need to push back on this. It was a lot of that, I think, more than anything. And also a lot of uncertainty around how much should we reveal? Like, what if they're actually just here to gather our SOPs and processes, and then they're just going to spin this up internally and back out of the deal. And I don't know that that's what happened, but we were really careful about what we would reveal. So I think there was just a lot of uncertainty on our side and a lot of, you know, it was like, originally I was positive on the deal. My business partner was like, it's okay. And then eventually it was like, I'm really not excited about this deal. And he's more excited about the deal. And so it was sort of like trying to understand what has shifted along the way in the terms and things like that. And here's what I would probably say to that is in a business, you have lots of hats you have to wear, but oftentimes there are people in the business that wear one hat more than the other. So I was very much wearing this shareholder hat and, you know, what's the equity value that's here? Whereas other people may be wearing different hats, whether it's the employee hat or the whatever hat, right? And sometimes those different hats can affect terms, price, et cetera, and what makes the most sense. And that can create tension in the business, right? In terms of like, you know, how do we unpack this in a way that makes it work for everybody? As I kind of keep saying, in reality, like, you know, you have to not always deals may like way I look about it back on it now is like, there just wasn't alignment in the beginning to like, so I don't even know that there was a good way to make it work for everybody. So if, you know, again, I'm experienced, but like, you know, I missed it again, you know, for a lot of reasons as we've unpacked.
Right. Which makes sense. But like, I also think what's an interesting highlight that, or it's an example that you just gave is that, I mean, I see it every day, Chris, where there's two business owners that are the shareholders, but they also have jobs. So in our training, we talk about separating the equity shareholder role versus the job role.
Yes.
But we layer this on the principle one of like, what the hell do you want? Like for your life and your job and all that stuff. And then like, what are your financial targets? And, you know, 99% of the time, I feel like, I mean, there's partners or family or other like stakeholders and you share this asset and people have different wants. I mean, we had these two guys that came through the training and 7 years apart, one's got a bunch of retirement. The other one doesn't. One loves the job. The other one doesn't. And it's like, so all of a sudden an out of the blue offer lands and it's like, they both see different things in that offer.
Yes.
Which just makes everything even more confusing because you're negotiating internally with also, as well as the future buyers and trying to align all these things. So I see it every day and it takes a lot of, you know, a lot of discussions, I guess. And that's what kind of goes back to one of my earlier comments of where is your mindset? Like you're just your energy or, you know, was it hard? Like exhaustion? I'm just kind of curious on like where you're at towards the end.
So the metaphor I use is I felt like I was in a hallway with one door partially open behind me and another door partially open in front of me, right? And that is not a great emotional place to be. It's like, if you look at my return on energy on this business relative to my time, it was not good. Like I emotionally, it was just super draining. And there's a real cost to even entering, in my opinion, and entering any transaction discussion like this, because it's really hard to run your business as if maybe this door will open or, but maybe it won't. But if it doesn't, then like, what does that mean? Like, cause we would have probably been hiring and trying to, you know, build up the infrastructure and stuff like that had we not entered this conversation with this acquirer. So it sort of puts things on pause and you try hard to run the business as if it weren't going to sell. But reality is that that's not always possible when you know, when you're stuck in the hallway. So I would just say that like, it was really tough. And I, you know, different people may have handled it very differently from me, but like, I am very much the kind of person that wants to build a consensus and I want everybody to be happy. And sometimes, you know, even if it means maybe I'm not perfectly happy with how it all goes. And so that made it even tougher. So anyway, yeah, I think emotionally very difficult time and made it really hard to run the business and make decisions while this was all a possibility.
Your analogy is amazing, dude. like hallway, two doors, man. I can relate to that so much. Cause like, how do you make a decision of whether you should hire someone, build your infrastructure or not? Right. I mean, like every day you're kind of just stuck in like no man's land. Cause you don't really know what the next outcome's going to be. And so how did you, so the deal falls apart. Mm-hmm. What'd you think? So like a door shuts, what was your mental thought process and where did you guys turn to next?
Well, I think one good thing that came out of it is we kind of understood how to get realigned as a company. And I think it pushed us more towards this boutique sort of, you know, really great clients, good repeat clients, like really specific narrow scopes, you know, good pricing, stuff like that. So ultimately we just kind of, you know, we licked our wounds for a little while and then hedgehogged around this idea of like, you know, let's fire our worst clients and let's like look, you know, let's really make our best clients happy. And, you know, ultimately the business still grew during that period of time. And, you know, we had really like a really profitable kind of boutique shop. Right. So, you know, and I want to say like we were, you know, if you're in doubt, it's always a good idea to optimize for optionality. So I knew that having a really profitable company in the short term would give us lots of optionality in terms of whether we decide to reinvest or whether we, you know, look at an exit or whatever. Like at the end of the day, like we had to kind of re-hedgehog around what's best for this business and what can we do with the, you know, the chess pieces on the board right now, mixing metaphors.
So all great metaphors though. And so where did it go from there then? So you guys was it like, hey, let's get this thing. When you say options, what options did you want? And then how did because obviously the story continues, right?
Yeah, after that. So where we were, you know, we hedgehogged, we built a profitable company. The systems were not quite so crazy, or like the amount of time and energy my business partner was spending because we made this boutique decision became a lot more manageable. And the company started to be, you know, a good one to own again, instead of just like, you know, kind of really stressful and chaotic. Mm-hmm. So now we were in a good place with the business and we were like, okay, well, you know, let's start looking at what this business would actually be worth and who would be the right buyer for this. And, you know, so I can say this because the acquirer was okay with me sharing this is, you know, we were doing seven figures in profit in the business. And so it was sort of the size of an SBA loan being a good fit for it. So kind of in that $1 to $5 million range, typically that's where, you know, mm-hmm. maybe like 1 to 6, depending on how much down payment, but typically SBA loans can be, the loan portion could be up to 5 million. So we thought, but being in the space, we also knew that an SBA loan buyer would give us really solid terms. Like we wouldn't have to deal with clawbacks or you actually can't have more
than it's cut and dry.
Yeah. You can't have more than 12 months as an owner in an employment agreement or contractor agreement or anything like that. It's just, you can't do it. The SBA and the underwriters don't allow it to happen. So we knew the terms on a deal like that. Most of your money comes up front, you know, all that kind of stuff would be really attractive. So we started thinking like, hey, why don't we like start to work towards a really profitable company this year. Let's get our tax returns in because that's super key for anybody who's going to be buying the business that is using an SBA loans. And let's make that look really, really healthy and strong, et cetera. And maybe next year we'll go, you know, look at putting this thing on the market and trying to find a buyer who can use an SBA loan. So in that process, I found a valuation company that does valuations for the banks that do the SBA loans. So I'm like, I'm gonna figure out like what would a company like this actually and how would they value our business? So we hired them to do a valuation on the company. This was kind of around the end of the year. And that gave us a feel for like, you know, what would a bank see this business as being worth? And how would they value it? And where are the roadblocks to a buyer potentially buying us if they were using an SBA loan? So we started to really think about who that ideal buyer would be. And we were thinking, you know, maybe some other agency who had some experience in at least the digital space. So they had some infrastructure to where, you know, if my business partner wouldn't be so tied to the business and things like that. So we started kind of thinking about who would that ideal buyer be. And, you know, fate would have it. One of our competitors reached out and said, hey, are there some ways we can collaborate? And, you know, those who don't know that generally, ends in, hey, maybe one of us should buy the other ones. That's how we started the new. So we're going to call the new buyer, the competitor. His name's Nate, but he approached us to buy the company. And side note, one of the reasons he knew this could be a good fit was because we'd been turning a lot of clients away and he'd been picking up those clients and he saw how good and the opportunity in the space as a result of that. So, and he knew they were coming from us.
That's awesome. So before we get into how, you know, what you learned from the first one to as you started pursuing this offer, I just wanted to make a comment too, because like, you know, what you're, what you're doing with the SBA loan, because all these bank underwriters, I'm just tying in from an earlier episode, Chris, to the intrinsic financial value. That's what a bank's underwriting. Like, you're going to take out a loan. Can you pay back that loan over 10 years? I mean, it's just real. So what's the risk of the cash flow versus like the strategic tuck in? So you guys, you had a baseline knowing like, hey, if a bank values it at this, that's kind of based on the operations of the business as it is, not judged on necessarily who that other person would be. So at least you kind of had like some white lines as far as like, here's what it is. So like when you going through that previous experience and then having this conversation with Nate as a competitor who understands what you're doing, did you have any list of like, here's what I'm not going to do this time, or here's exactly what I want? Where like, how did you go into that conversation based on the what you learned from the previous one?
Yeah, I guess it's a metaphor day for me, but so
I love it, man. Stories.
Here's what I had in my head is I see this initial conversation to, you know, this deal closing and having a successful transition being a whole bunch of dominoes lined up. And they have to be knocked over in the right sequence. And there are things that will prevent the next one from being knocked over. So I really started to identify what were those dominoes that could be deal killers, essentially would be a simple way to put it, or roadblocks that could be deal killers. And I started to have the conversation with this competitor buyer to get as many of those out in the open as quickly as I could. At a high level, because sometimes you can't get specific. In our case, because he's a competitor, we can't just tell him who our clients are or anything like that, you know? So more it was, let's find out, does he have the money to do this? Like, first off, right? So is he financially capable to do this? And found out, okay, he's looking to use an SBA loan. And so I, you know, first thing I'm like, hey, what's the first domino there? Well, let's find out if he can get pre-approved for a loan. That doesn't mean approved finally, but it means at least the loan, they at least will take it to a bank with him as the person guaranteeing it, right? So went through that process, you know. So different steps like that I laid out, and I kind of laid out how much I would reveal along the way and kept in my mind all the time that this deal is not going to work out, but still being optimistic. So it was like keeping the paradox of the two going at the same time. This deal isn't going to happen, but I'm optimistic and I'm going to do all I can to make sure it happens. You know, so I tried to clear as many roadblocks as early as possible at a high level. And then over time, just, you know, kind of continue the process from there. And I knew there were a couple really big roadblocks. The main one being getting our tax returns in and the bank underwriting department, you know, basically committing to say, yes, we will do this loan. So we tied a lot of things to that actually happening. And then we had some concerns around, you know, this being a competitor, and we built some stuff into the terms of the deal and stuff like that, which, you know, that's something to consider. But the big thing with this competitor was kind of understanding that he understood this business. He already had infrastructure in place to do the work that my business partner was doing. So that versus any, like, okay, so we talked about the aggregator, we're talking about the competitor now. Let's just take like Joe Blow off the street, who's coming out of corporate, has never done due diligence, anything like that. They're using an SBA loan. What we imagine in our mind is that person would really want my business partner sticking around for as long as possible. And there's a lot of risk in that transition. So there's a lot more risk that deal could fall apart once they realize how much specialized knowledge there was in doing this kind of work. So we knew that roadblock was actually due to the nature of who he was as a competitor was much more likely to be cleared earlier on and would hopefully have allowed a better transition for myself and my business partner as a result. So, you know, the nature
well, what of I think is super,
was that buyer actually cleared some roadblocks.
Well, it's super important highlight too, because like, I mean, the SBA loan, you know, our friend Walker Diable and the buy, then build and all these people that are out there talking about entrepreneur through acquisition, search funds or whatever. There's like that combination of how important it is that person's ability to continue to run that company because they have to service the debt. So like the person's got to know what the hell they're doing because they have to keep the company running to pay the payments. Just that simple, right? Yes. And where you, instead of having to find like, because I see it a lot in like the home services, Chris, where it's like master electrician, got 8 employees. You can't just, you and I don't know shit about like, you know, being an electrician. So I can't go in there and do that and have that role. But, you know, someone that has that job is able to do that, continue to grow it. And that's such a huge part with the SBA loan. And so your competitor already knew what you were doing,
yes.
Right? So it's almost kind of similar to that analogy, but I also wanted to highlight for the listeners too, because when you explain the dominoes that you needed to fall in order, the SBA loan already handled the payment up front and the deal structure. You don't have to give any numbers, but you want to just maybe give a little bit more of a flyby on like what that means, because like all of the crap that you dealt with the first one is just not even possible
exactly
with an SBA loan. So like, I don't know if you leaned on that as just kind of like the gold standard of how you wanted it. I don't know what my question is, if making sense.
Yeah. So let me just say in what you just said in different terms, to some degree, the SBA determines the terms of the deal. Because number one, I can't have rollover equity in the buyer's business. That's just not, they just don't allow it. I as the owner, or any other owner, can't have any kind of employment agreement of any kind, contract or whatever, for more than a year. So that's off the table entirely. There's no such thing as clawbacks. That just isn't, you know, really something you can do. Like maybe that is possible, but I don't know for sure. But
I don't know. I don't know if it is, Chris.
Yeah.
Like a clawback as far
to me
as
it's
like
once the genie's out of the bottle with the funds, it's like you can't put them back in. anyway, so you know, like a lot of we knew that going in. So really, it was more a discussion around price and then how much. So very commonly, the banks actually want to see some degree of seller financing involved. Typically, that's going to be under 10%, 10% or below. And that was the case in our situation. So we knew we'd get, you know, more than a majority of funds up front, just due to the nature of how these deals get funded and the terms that are required by the banks and the SBA underwriting requirements and all of that. So, and that note, I can go into a couple of, like one thing we learned, it was almost a hiccup in the deal if you want. Related to the underwriting requirements of the SBA, if it's helpful. But we did carry a small note, and originally it was going to be, you know, kind of like a 5-year note, and we'd start getting payments pretty quickly. But we found out is that our growth in the company was quite fast over the last previous, you know, couple years, and we didn't know how much the SBA rules would put onto that previous calendar year. Turns out they look at both two calendar years previous and actually average them out. So, and then they compare that to the debt to income ratio for servicing the debt. So what happened was because of the seller note we structured was starting to get paid right away, that actually had to go into the debt to income ratios. And it started to make the price be maybe not as good, or the terms that we had laid out being not as good. But we found a way around that by we put our loan on standby, meaning we don't get any payments for 2 years. So that removes the debt to income entirely. And what
awesome.
I learned, little behind the scenes thing, is that most banks will end up selling the loan after a couple of years. So they're off the hook. You know, for most of it, I think they're pretty much off the hook. So they really only care about kind of that first 2-year period, I believe. And I don't know how much that's true, but that's kind of how I interpreted it, reading the tea leaves.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And just personal experience, the bank that we were dealing with in 2012 that absolutely sucked, they had sold the SBA loan, so they couldn't actually refi us because they were under a distress disorder from the FDIC. So they actually couldn't help us because they weren't doing anything besides collecting the commissions off of servicing the SBA loan. So like, I've heard that from quite a few people. Like once, like you said, the genie out of the bottle, the toothpaste is out of the tooth, the tube. Like you can't, like the, it's just, it's all there, right? So I think that's probably why they're pretty stringent on the deal structure and just the kind of the limited availability of the deal structure. You had mentioned in a little bit previously that the seller, or I'm sorry, that the buyer was going through some terms and conditions or some. What was that now that you laid the groundwork of kind of how the SBA is structured? So where was the gray area of negotiation as far as the additional terms?
So, okay. So just to finish the point of a lesson I learned was, let's say that most deals have a note, a seller note. What we did was our initial LOI, we started with half of what we were willing to accept in terms of a percentage of the deal, to give us some breathing room if an issue like this came up. So we actually had in some ways kind of planned for this a little bit. And so we were able to accomplish, you know, number one, doing the standby terms, and then also bumping up the percentage. So the price of the deal didn't change. Our terms got a little bit worse on the seller financing, but it wasn't like a big chunk of the deal. So we were able to make that all kind of go through. Other terms that, you know, if you compare like the previous acquirer, the aggregator, you know, potential acquirer, all this crazy stuff on us sticking around and things like that, really the only thing that needed to get negotiated was whether or not our clients would stick around. So the key, going back to the motivation, the competitor, his key motivation was to acquire the brand, its position in the market. You know, we were kind of the brand in this space, and also the clients that we had, the repeat clients. Those were kind of like the real value points that he saw in the business, even more so than, you know, the talent. The, you know, it wasn't like he was acquiring us. The transition was basically one key area of negotiation. So we had to figure out, you know, how do we define what is an acceptable transition? So that was an area we had to figure out. And then the non-compete was one we went back and forth quite a bit with. You know, most sellers want to keep the non-compete very, very narrow and very, very short. Most buyers want it to be like all things,
10 years,
everything, and very, very long. So with the original aggregator, it was like a shorter period of time, but, you know, kind of relatively broad, just like you can't work with anybody else in the space that might be doing the same thing as us. Whereas with, you know, learning that lesson, this non-compete, it was like, let's define exactly what Centurica is. And we're willing to say that we're not going to compete in due diligence services kind of thing. Right. And so that was another area that was hard, you know, as a buyer like that, if we were just to spin up a new competing company after a couple of years, that's obviously tough. So that was an area that we had to work through. And then, but I'd say probably the only other one would have been reps and warranties related to clients that are in good standing. So I got some good advice on this one from another friend who'd sold a service business. You want to surface any problem clients as early as possible. You want to, like, if they're going to like last minute ask you to meet all of your clients, like, you want to know that as quickly as possible. So I was surfacing, you know, like, what are you envisioning for due diligence around clients? Because that was the most sensitive area. But ultimately what we landed on was basically we were repping and warranting in the legal agreement that our top whatever percentage of clients are in good standing and haven't told us that they were, you know, going to not, you know, not work with us anymore or anything like that. So basically, like, that was a key area we had to figure out a solution for, is because that the key value point for the buyer was clients. So how do we give him certainty that, you know, things are in good shape with clients, right?
So this client topic is an interesting one too, because the two different people wanted to do completely different things with your business.
Yes.
And one of them wanted, you know, the aggregator had their own reason for the 6 months and doing more deals. This is a competitor. Mm-hmm. And it's always a dicey issue when you get to the client sharing. So, like, any thoughts, or like, how did you handle that? Or any thoughts for, you know, what, you know, people always think about that, because I went through the same exact thing.
Yeah.
Like, show me your client list. And it's like, no, thank you. But at the end of the day, it's always going to come down to, you know, the actual due diligence that needs to be done.
Yeah. So, two big pieces here. Number one is early on in the process with the LOI, I put in a non-compete and a non-solicit for both clients that we already have. If they discover clients that we have in the due diligence process, they then can't go after them. They can't solicit them ever again. So that's a lot of pain. If this deal wouldn't have gone through for him, he couldn't have, in theory, couldn't have gone after any of our clients, right? He couldn't have solicited any of them. So that could have had a real impact on his business going forward. If you wanted to grow into the type of clients we were working with. And then the other is the domino analogy. So we sequenced, there were certain things we were willing to reveal, but so one key domino was bank commitment letter. That basically means the bank's going to do this. They've approved the loan. They're going to fund it, you know. That is a huge roadblock that was a make or break for this. And it took a long time to get that and stuff like that. So basically we were like, anything super sensitive, so client names, we kept till after that period. So that was one way we navigated around it. So we provided data that was like sales by client, but it didn't specify who the client was.
Like client one, client two, like, yeah. Hey, 50 grand, whatever it is, just saying like they will validate these after this other domino.
Exactly. And I should say, like, credit to my buyer. Like, he was awesome about this. Like, we had regular weekly meetings to keep communication going. Like, that's super key. We were communicating through this whole process, like solving issues together. And he was not the kind of guy who was like extremely skeptical that I was trying to deceive him or anything like that. And, you know, in fact, he did have an investor that was kind of playing the bad cop a little bit. And that made me have a little echo with the previous deal. But, you know, but what I did early on to solve that was, like, I said, hey, if this investor backs out, you know, what is your plan? And he was willing to still do the deal, even if the investor like backed out and stuff like that. So I felt like I had confidence that this deal could happen, even if this investor became a problem later. But anyway, yeah. So I think I answered your question there.
Yeah, no, you did. That's awesome. And so, I mean, how's your head now? I mean, like, I don't know if you, for the listeners, how recent has been the closing and like, are you happy?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I think a lot of people want to know.
Yeah, man. Well, actually, if you sell a business, people always ask you, how are you doing and what's next? So be prepared for those two questions. But so we closed the deal, I believe it was end of April, 2022. And it's been a couple months. And I just would say that I feel like lighter. That's the simplest word I can use. I just feel much lighter. And the transition like went relatively well, all things considered. You know, we're like the new buyer has really done well. He's like taking over ops and like everything has gone well. And, you know, so like all things considered, things went well. And I felt a lot of pressure to, you know, cause I have a reputation in the industry and like, I don't want to be known as the guy who screws some buyer, you know, and sells them a lemon or something like that. So like, I felt a lot of pressure and also like really cared about our clients as well. Like I want to make sure they were getting taken care of really well. So felt a lot of pressure to keep the buyer supported through that transition. Anyway, my business partner was awesome through that. The buyer was awesome through that. So like all things ended up well. I feel much lighter just, you know, I no longer feel like I'm in the hallway. And that's like, that's just such a good feeling and, you know, I get to focus on some projects that I've never really had the ability to just only focus on my event Rhodium and all that. And so I'm really excited to do that for a little while.
That's awesome, man. And you know, it's, I always bring up Bo's finished big book, but, he always said, people always ask you, so what do you do? And you're like, well, I used to, and like, and slow down so many people. And you've got a lot of other hobbies, and man, you have a lot of passions and stuff that you have always going on. And you see a lot of entrepreneurs that sell their companies too. Any words of advice as far as like going, like leaning into something? Did that factor into, you know, some of your decision making along the way?
Yeah. So I got a lot of advice. I run a community that's for people who are really interested in mergers or, you know, acquisitions and exits and operating these businesses. So there's people that have had much, much like substantially larger exits than I have, who are yourself included in the community and have given me a lot of great feedback. And that's the benefit, I think, to just having good people around you who've already done this. There are a lot, and I should say, like, you know, having somebody like Ryan or his team that you can call and be like, hey, you know, I'm dealing with this issue with the bank. Have you experienced this? Like, is this normal? Is this buyer asking for something that's crazy? Like I was lucky enough to have the community around me that would allow me to do that. So I felt really well supported from that regard and got some good advice. Like one of them is the time frame, I've heard different things, but my rule is no new projects for 6 months after closing. So a lot of people, I think they'll just jump into the next thing too quickly. And that's a common thing I heard. Don't invest the money right away. People will put the money into really stupid things. And, you know, to set a timeline on that. And also, like, if you happen to have people in your life who hear about this and maybe they think you're like a lottery winner and they're going to go ask you for money or whatever, like, my understanding is that kind of fades if you just basically say, oh, I can't even touch the money right now. I can't invest it in anything, like, you know. And then over, you know, if you wait long enough, that kind of fades and you know, and then you can start looking at other options and stuff. I don't know. I think probably don't sell it in your mind until the money's in the bank. You know, I had to maintain that mindset, this paradox of like, this deal is not going to happen. Even to the day that the money hit our bank account, I assumed this deal wasn't going to happen. And I was prepared for that potential outcome. So I think, I think that's just like, that's not really
what helped you do that.
And I think that helped me.
No, I want to interrupt for a second. That's an important point, because you said the word optionality, which is like, honestly, at the end of the day, that's what we want for everybody. Mm-hmm. And so like, what helped you keep that mindset? Was it a plan B that you knew what it was worth, or like what allowed you to not spend the money and be like 2 weeks from summer vacation, which is what I see happen all the time?
Yeah. Well, I had the unique benefit to selling the company in my mind just about 6 months prior to that with the aggregator. So I learned that lesson, you know, and that pain, you know, it was very fresh. That scar tissue was not gone. So I think it was more that like, I didn't want to go through that emotional roller coaster again. So, and learning the lesson, like literally, Ryan, we were shutting down the business as we were approaching closing, because we had no signal from the buyer, the aggregator buyer, that they were going to back out of the deal. Like, we were at the 2-yard line, you know, turning all of our clients away, wrapping up projects. Like, we had literally started doing that because they wanted to hit the ground running right away. So,
so not shutting it down because the deal didn't close, but because they were just going to acquire you, like, you were going to get rid of everybody.
Yeah. So that is dumb. I was dumb. I mean, it was really, really dumb. It was not, I forgot, you know, we weren't doing what was best for the business. We thought it was a done deal. The deal is not done until that money hits your account. And even then, you know, could be lawsuits and stuff like that. So like, who knows what could happen in the future. But yeah, so I think that mindset, but not letting it detract you or turn the buyer off. That's another thing. Like, I have a mastermind group and I ask them like, hey, like I recognize I have all this scar tissue from this previous deal. If you were a buyer, like, what would you want from me right now? Because what I had been doing was trying to control the process and like surface all the problems that could happen. But what I was forgetting was that like, hey, this buyer, I was maybe doing at the expense of empathy for the buyer, right? So what I did was I let the buyer start leading, right? And you know, kind of tried to turn that off a little bit and not rush that process. So yeah, I think like, I don't know. I'll pause there. I feel like I'm digressing a little bit.
No, I just, you know, everything you're going through, I mean, I've heard it, I've been through it. So like, I get it, man. And it's like, they call it the deal train. I don't know what else I could say. Cause like, you grab the train and it pulls you, and it's emotionally, and it's all these advisors making money and they're all mm-hmm. vested into the deal. And so like, you almost feel like you lose control, and you have to like dig your freaking heels in and know what you want, so you can just essentially, you know, probably fight against your advisors, fight against the buyers. It's I don't know, man, it's trench warfare. Yeah. I don't know what else to put it.
And it's really annoying that I literally felt like I was fighting against my attorney. Like you just said, fighting against your advisors, I didn't feel like he was on my team at all. It was like, it seems weird that would be the case, but you know, they obviously are there for a reason and to look out for your best interests and stuff, but it's not very collaborative.
But I don't know, man. It all depends on their actions, right? I mean, you and I are both too damn nice, man. Like, you're such a nice person. It's like, okay, the reality is 95% of people out there are jumping at the next billable hour, next commission, next transaction, because they're human beings, and I don't blame them for it. But finding the people that are going to do what's right, even in the face of a lot of adversity, is just, it's hard, man. Especially if you're not, if you don't understand how to judge, you can judge their character, but you don't know how to judge their skill sets, or you can judge their skill sets, but you don't know how to judge their character without time. I don't know. It's definitely an art to finding the right people.
For sure.
So Chris, man, I appreciate you sharing the story, man. It's fresh. And so you are very humble to say you would be willing to share the story. So I can't thank you enough. Two final questions for you. Contact information, where to find you, Rhodium, what's the best place to get in touch with you?
Yeah. You know, I would say rhodiumweekend.com, RHODIUM would be the simplest place. So how it works is, I actually talk to everybody before I invite them into the community. So if you want to have a call with me, just apply and you can schedule one. And then, yeah, so that's, I don't really have anything else to offer at this point or like, you know, contact if I'm sort of on Facebook. I'm barely ever on Twitter. You know, I'm on LinkedIn, but I hardly, my assistant checks it for me. So, you know, just go to a call and talk to me.
And what I heard, so like, let me, if I heard this right, what I heard is everybody contact you, ask for money and for an investment, ask for, no, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I know you're traveling and soaking it in, man. The last question, man, I'd love to know what people think of the word intentional, what their definition is, because it's the name of the show. And so I'm just curious, in your world, what does the word intentional mean?
People get so much out of the stuff that I do, and it's really hard to define exactly what it is when you ask them, like, what is Rhodium or whatever, right? But the one through line, I've been trying to find, what is the through line? And I think the through line might be around helping people achieve kind of their ideal life, whatever that is to them, what makes them happy, but do it through business, right? So that there is at least that connectivity with it. And so, you know, I think intentional growth would be growing towards the ideal life that you ultimately want in the context of, you know, sort of what we talk about commonly in business and stuff like that. So.
Dude, love it. Love it. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Hope everybody got something from it. And I look forward to hopefully chatting soon with you, Ryan.
Well, that's a wrap for this mini series. I really hope you enjoyed the interview with Chris. I think it just was a wonderful example to show you how building a company that's got good, healthy cash flow will always give you a plan B, because you can turn around and do an SBA loan, an internal buyout. You can do an ESOP if it's big enough. You can do whatever you want if you focus on growing the value of your company based on that intrinsic value. And if you wanted to sell to a third party, like Chris did, or a lot of people and obviously do, as long as you know you can fall back on a valuation that is engineered the right way, because it's you've hit your financial targets, and principle two of the intentional growth principles, you've hit your financial targets based on the value of the company, based on the net proceeds you would get, based on the intrinsic financial value. And then you could go negotiate with third parties, whether it's a private equity firm, strategic buyer, or you name it. You can hold true and dig your heels in on the terms, conditions, and value, because you know that you've got options because of the value of the business based on the intrinsic value. So if you wanted to go in and learn more about how to organize your company financials so you can see what the intrinsic value could be, go check out the Intentional Growth Financial Assessment. It's at arcona.io or in the show notes. 22 questions. You get a score on each of the areas of the financials. And then on the results page, Pat and I walk through a case study of what good looks like, so you can project out the future value of your company and have a lot of leverage when you're negotiating with people going forward. Thanks everybody for tuning in. And just as a note, our next mini series is going to be the role of a CFO as a guide in value creation and mergers and acquisitions. We're going to be diving into how you can leverage that role to essentially accomplish value creation and M&A and march towards that future valuation that you want. I hope everybody has a good week, and I will see you next week.